Microsoft BitLocker Administration Monitoring. So he's joined us to tell you some technical details about the product. And of course, you're here to learn more about what's in Windows 8 BitLocker. So we're going to allow you to understand like what's the key differences between 7 and 8, and what did we just deliver in our new version of the product, NBAM 2.0. And I'll tell you what, I'm a little surprised by the size of the room they gave us, but this is an excellent crowd, actually, for BitLocker. I mean, BitLocker is kind of a geeky technology, but this is a great crowd, so thank you for your interest in the area. As we go through here, we're going to go through the top features of BitLocker in Windows 8. We're going to talk about the new features that we just delivered recently in 2.0. We're going to help you understand, like, how do you configure it, how can you deploy it, give you some highlights there. And then we'll also show you what the user experience looks like. And then the key takeaways should be that Windows 8 is super easy and fast to provision, especially when you compare it to previous versions of Windows, BitLocker, and then 2.0 solves a lot of the key pain points that customers told us about, maybe many of you, about what we had in 1.0. So agenda-wise, we'll start with 8, then we'll go into our 2.0 section, we'll talk about how to configure 2.0, and then we'll go into the user experience aspects of 2.0. So let's start with our discussion on BitLocker and Windows 8, kind of compare and contrast where we've been. So if you're familiar with provisioning an encryption product, whether it's BitLocker on Windows 7 or maybe Vista, or maybe a third-party product like from McAfee or Symantec or Sophos, something you are acutely aware of is the amount of time that it takes to provision the encryption to a device. If you've got a 300-gigabyte drive, or maybe you've got a 1-terabyte drive, maybe let's use that as an example, you probably remember taking a lot of time to provision encryption to that device. And so I've talked to a lot of customers who are just starting to provision Windows 8 at scale in their organization, and they tell me about literally they have labs with PCs on desks, and they're spread all over the place, maybe multiple layers, and they have maybe dozens and dozens of PCs just encrypting and getting ready for provisioning. And so it takes a lot of space, and it obviously takes a lot of time, and this really delays the provisioning of the product, right? In fact, encryption, whether it's our product or somebody else's, could double or triple the amount of time it takes to actually lay down an image. So this is a big pain point the customers wanted addressed. In addition, the Trusted Platform Module, which is critical, you really need hardware to secure data, right? You don't want to do it all in software because software can be compromised. That TPM chip in devices also proved challenging to our customers to provision. So they went through gymnastics, maybe the user went through reboots or the IT shop was rebooting the PC a number of times to get that prepared. And so with Windows 8, we want to address those two key pain points, the time it takes as well as the TPM management. And we've added new instrumentation in Windows 8 that makes it very easy to provision TPM. Before, you had to go through the reboots, you had to maybe use some scripting, you had to know what you're doing, or NBAM actually made it quite easy, but it still required reboots to maybe prepare the TPM. Now it can be fully owned, is what we call that, behind the scenes, by the NBAM agent or by BitLocker if you're using it in isolation. And it just works, just the way it should. So TPM hassles and pain have been eliminated with Windows 8. The next thing we wanted to do is we wanted to make sure that speed issue that I mentioned, that we could address that. We did it in a number of ways. The most popular way in the short term will be with a technology that we called use disk space only encryption. So if you have a 1 terabyte drive and you're laying down a 30 gigabyte image, why would we encrypt almost a terabyte's worth of zeros, right, have no data on it? So with Windows 8, use disk space only encryption encrypts the data as it's being written, and then when the desktop's provisioned, the user has new data is written by the user or by other systems and processes, that data will be encrypted as well. So you can see 10 times, 20 times, 30 times or more performance improvement when it comes to the provisioning of the encryption to the device when you move to Windows 8. So this is a huge, huge improvement. If you want to go even better than that, there's a new hard drive type called an encrypted hard drive. And that's a brand name. That's not like a type of drive. That actually represents the brand name of the drive. And it's actually a replacement, at least on the Windows platform, for self-encrypting drives. SEDs, which many of you have probably asked about or considered, are a drive that do all of the encryption on the disk itself, and then the encryption solution from McAfee or Symantec does key management on the drive. So you get instantaneous high-performance encryption because the disk does all the heavy lifting, and then your encryption software basically does key management. So this is an ideal scenario because your disk is always encrypted at all times, and then technology like BitLocker, for instance, can just set the keys, and it only takes a few moments. So we support this new drive type. It's just starting to show up on the marketplace, so it may be difficult to find in this moment. We expect later in the year that you'll see OEMs shipping devices that include this technology, so keep your eyes open for that. But you can find these drives on Newegg. I think Western Digital, I believe, has a couple of options, and there's others from Seagate, Hitachi, and others that are coming. So this is probably the long-term solution that we move to disks that do all that heavy lifting, and BitLocker really becomes a management layer on top of it. One thing that's nice about Windows 8 as well is we've improved the performance of provisioning the encryption during the imaging process. So if you're using, you know, System Center or MDT to deploy the image, you can actually implement use disk space encryption in band with the image being laid down. In contrast to what we could do on Windows 7, where you laid down your image, and then after that's done, then you kick off encryption as a separate process. So now we can do it in parallel, in band, and that's going to give you a dramatic performance increase as well. So when it comes to the overall value proposition of 8, it's all about speeding up the process of provisioning. Another thing we tried to do with Windows 8 is improve the user experience. Now, on typical devices like laptops and desktops, I think the experience is really good. The user experience improvement that I'm referring to is really on tablets. And this will trickle down into desktops and laptops down the road. A lot of people have asked me, hey, Chris, where's the pre-boot authentication option on my tablets? And it's a complex answer, sadly, but the short is there isn't a pre-boot option on tablets. And the reason why is you actually don't need it anymore. And the reason why is this. So if we roll back the clock and try to remember why we even did pre-boot in the first place, a lot of people don't remember, they never knew. Pre-boot authentication is to address two types of attacks on the PC. These are called cold boot attacks, and there's really two vectors. Vector number one is where somebody attacks the PC and tries to steal the encryption keys for BitLocker or maybe a third-party technology by plugging a device into a DMA port like FireWire. Once they've done that, they can dump the system memory, and then they can use tools that are easily found on the internet to steal the key or identify the key within the memory. They can then use that key to decrypt the volume, and then they're in. All right, so it requires a DMA port. And DMA ports are, in some respects, kind of going away on the Windows platform, especially on mobile. I don't know if any new devices being shipped today include FireWire port. I think that probably hasn't happened because USB 3.0 came, and those days are pretty much over on laptops, convertibles, these types of things. In the case of tablets, there's a new architecture standard that we're promoting. It's called Connected Standby. The primary feature of Connected Standby is to provide a mobile phone-like capability for your tablet, right? For those of you who have an iPad or a mobile phone, you'll remember you turn it on, it's instantly on, and everything's ready to go. You have new mail. It's all there, right? We have that type of capability now on Windows tablets as well, and that's actually going to trickle down even into desktops in the short term here. But basically, this architecture restricts the use of DMA ports. You cannot have a DMA port on this type of device. So the tablets out there, in many cases, they're restricted from the use of these dangerous ports. So you're just not going to find them. So that attack vector is gone. When it comes to the second attack vector, that's about where somebody freezes the PC. They maybe use Freon to freeze the memory, and they then try to remove that memory, and they can then lift the encryption keys that way. That's more of a lab attack. It's not reliable. There's actually a lot of information out there that proves that, okay, you theoretically can do this, but the likelihood that you'll be able to do this on a device that you find or steal from somebody, the likelihood is very, very low. When we go back to this connected standby scenario and we talk about mobile devices, you're actually going to see memory is actually soldered onto the motherboard. So that attack vector doesn't even work on a Surface RT or a Surface Pro or all these tablets. Those devices are not designed to have extended memory. So the memory you get in that device is the only memory you'll ever have. And so they've soldered that on, and that also helps them give you a very thin device. So the cold boot attacks that we're all familiar with, that we've been using pre-boot authentication to protect ourselves from the attacks, they're really not applicable to these types of devices. So you don't need a keyboard on a tablet, and you don't need pre-boot in most cases. Now, there might be some exceptions because we don't control what our OEMs do, but that's going to be more right than wrong. So last thing we've done it goes in concert with that feature. A lot of people are just concerned about their PCs being booted and being available on the network. They're worried about somebody going into the Windows sign-in experience and maybe brute-forcing their way and trying to find maybe a weak password. To address that, that concern, we've added improved anti-hammering logic on the Windows sign-in, and we actually leverage BitLocker as our way to get there. You can set a policy that will put BitLocker into recovery mode if a failed attack on the Windows sign-in occurs. So you can set this policy to 5 failed attempts or 10 failed attempts, but when that threshold is met, the PC automatically reboots. The keys to unlock the drive are actually encrypted on the PC, and the PC goes into recovery mode. So that person who stole that device or found the device will never get into the PC at that point unless they're able to compromise your help desk and convince them to give the recovery keys away, which, of course, would never happen in any of your organizations. So anyway, that's kind of the short story on the user experience. The other thing we're doing, we did in Windows 8, is we've added some improvements for servers. We support SANs, server clusters. We also have a new protector that's going to be very interesting for servers and also interesting for maybe kiosks or shared desktop PCs. It's called the Network Protector. So on a desktop PC, it's very possible that you'll see a port like Thunderbolt, or maybe even you have existing desktops with FireWire. And so you could mitigate the cold boot attack vector by maybe disabling those ports, but if you didn't want to go down that road, you could use the network protector as a means to deal with it. The network protector basically is a protector that works kind of like this. You set the TPM protector plus the PIN or network protector. So when that device, that let's imagine it's a kiosk, is plugged into your corporate network, that PC reboots, it's actually going to go make a call at the UEFI level, so even before Windows starts. Actually, the Windows loader does it. It's going to actually do a DHCP call to a WDS service on your network. That service will unlock the volume, assuming the disk is still in the same device with the same TPM, and then the network unlocks the volume. So it is a two-factor authentication. This is awesome for servers. This is great for desktops. It doesn't work great for mobile because it requires a wired connection. So keep that in mind. So that's another great feature there. When it comes to 8.1, BitLocker is basically the same as it was in 8.0. But we did make one change that's going to be interesting for you to be aware of. Device encryption is a variation of BitLocker. It's a form that is automatically provisioned to the device. So when you turn a Windows RT device on or a Windows Phone 8 device, device encryption is automatically provisioned, and the keys are stored in SkyDrive. Our customers have absolutely loved this feature because they don't want to go through the pain of provisioning it anyway. We've taken device encryption, which was just on those two editions, and it's now in every edition of Windows. If the device meets connected standby certification requirements, we will automatically provision that technology and encrypt the volume. And then when you choose to manage it with MBAM, it instantly starts adding BitLocker capability on top of it. There's no conversion, no hassle, no mess to deal with. It just becomes BitLocker almost effectively automatically. And so with that, I'd like to bring Paul up. Again, Paul's from the engineering team, and he's going to tell you all about the details of 2.0 and what we've done.
All right. Thanks, Chris. Hi, guys. So like Chris mentioned, my name is Paul. I work for the MBAM team. And before we start, just want to get some logistics out of the way. I have a lot of material to cover. I'm going to try to show you guys three demos today. So if you can hold your questions until the end, I'm going to try really hard to give you some time to ask the questions. Otherwise, I'll be downstairs at the booth tomorrow, the day after tomorrow, so you guys can stop by and ask if you have any specific questions about the product. So actually, before we go through the content, just a quick show of hands, just curious, how many of you have worked with MBAM, have seen at least play with a beta or something like that? All right, yeah, it's pretty much half. So I want to give you a quick introduction on what MBAM is, what MBAM 1.0 was about, and then we're going to talk about the improvements that we have for 2.0. We're going to have pretty much three sections through the presentation, talk about standalone, CM, and then user experience. So I'm going to go step by step and try to show you guys how that looks like. So the first step for me, the way I memorize, you know, what MBAM is about, like call the MDOT products, we do not try to reinvent the wheel. We're a management layer on top of BitLocker. So Chris was talking about all the features for BitLocker, and MBAM leverages BitLocker for encryption. So every time you hear encryption, every time you hear protectors, we are just on top of BitLocker. MBAM is not trying to actually encrypt your drive. That will be done by BitLocker. Well, we do provide, the way I memorize this, as if we didn't have enough acronyms throughout the our engineering world is the MRR. We provide management, recovery, and reports. So we're going to talk about management, the fact that we have the MBEM agent that allows you to push policy, enforce that policy. We ask for your key. We give you the option to save that key to a SQL database instead of the BitLocker option to save it in AD. Some companies don't like that. So we're going to talk about the life cycle of the policy and how MBEM allows you to enforce that policy. Then you have the recovery part, which is one of the main advantages that BitLocker has over other products. We really try hard not to have cases where you just lose data. So what MBEM does is before we do anything to your drive, before we even try to encrypt, we ask for that recovery key, which is a protector that's applied along with whatever other protectors you have on your volume. And that protector will always give you that, you know, safeguard that, oh, I forgot my PIN or I typed my password but something happens, not working. You can always use the recovery key and get access to your data. And we're going to show you what are the websites and all the tools that we give you to manage that. And then finally, reports, which is, you know, the management part is you giving the end user the chance to comply with their policy. Now, the end user always can, you know, do things that you're not expecting. You need to ensure how many people actually encrypted the volumes in your enterprise. Sometimes hardware might give you issues, so we'll allow you to see what machines are having TPM issues, what machines are encrypted but not up to the policy that you set. So we have reports both on CM and standalone that will give you that information. So looking at where we were on MBEM 1.0 and where we went with 2.0 is we continue to improve on compliance and security. We're going to talk about some changes that we did to our setup. Some of the feedback we got was we were being a bit too strict when we were installing the servers. So some people are saying, well, you're asking me to do something here that another person in my company has the rights. And it was all back to the whole AD issue, right? You're managing MBAM. You don't want to manage AD because there's another team. So did some improvements there. We did some improvements on the client flow. So, you know, we try to minimize the impact for the end user. So we try to show a message explaining exactly what's happening so the end user can comply with your policy. We also made a move, and we created actually a brand new mode for MBAM. That's the System Center Configuration Mode. I'm going to be calling it CM, which is just short for Configuration Manager. So what we started to do there is try to integrate, again, following the MDOP idea that we're not trying to reinvent the wheel. So we moved some of the functionality that we had on standalone to CM, and we replicated some of that functionality there as well. So you still have the option of deploying MBAM as a standalone thing, but now you have the option of integrating parts of it with your CM deployment. And then finally, just reducing costs, looking at, you know, ways to help enterprises save money. So talking about recovery, we had the help desk portal for MBAM V1. Now for V2, for instance, we have the self-service portal. So as of before, you always had a help desk call when you had an end user go into recovery. Now you have the option of setting up a portal out there that your users can go there by themselves and recover their drives. So it might not be 100% of your users, but any calls saved there will help you save money as well. All right, so looking at the technical investments we made for 2.0, we basically focus on four pillars. The CM integration I was talking about, so we're going to show that over the demo. We allow you to report compliance, and we allow you to view the reports in CM. We're still saving the recovery keys and audit information on a standalone, but now we're saving the compliance data to CM. That has some advantages. We're going to talk about it. And even the reports you'll see, they have some small improvements that the standalone version will not have it. Now, this is, of course, optional. If you look at the integration with CM, we're not saying you have to deploy CM in order to deploy MBAM. It's more to leverage your existing CM deployment if it's already there. Windows 8 support, Chris talked about several of the features that BitLocker is adding for Windows 8, and BitLocker covers a very wide range of scenarios, including consumer and some, you know, and enterprise as well. MBAM focused solely on enterprise, so we did add support for Windows 8 on the top scenarios that we thought were super important for enterprises. So first of all, we support Windows 8 clients. If you want to encrypt Windows 8 clients, they'll be supported out of the box. We added support for Windows to Go, which means support for non-TPM machines, and we'll talk about that more as we go along. And we also made sure to test, you know, Windows 8, all the new modes, like when you do auto-provisioning, we play well with that. Our TPM key recovery plays well with that, and now I'll talk about the little details on that as well. But overall, Windows 8 is supported on the server side and client side for MBAM. Self-service, I mentioned this is basically the web portal that we have for key recovery. We'll have a demo on that, and that's, you know, it sounds like just a small improvement, but it's really a big game changer. We'll allow you now to do the recovery for both OS drives and FDDs using the self-service portal. If it's an OS drive, you need to go to another machine, but the scenario that I'm going to show here, where you have an FDD, a fixed data drive that it's into recovery, you could do it all from your computer, and you don't even need to call help desk or do anything about that. And then finally, customer feedback. I mean, all those other three areas were also based on customer feedback, but then we had a bunch of miscellaneous changes that we made to the product that were really mostly based on what customers were telling us. So we had the, for instance, the TDE requirement that we removed. So now you can use SQL standard. You don't need to use SQL Enterprise. We were doing some, we were requiring you guys to set up SPNs while you were installing the product. Now we allow you to do that off band. When we look at the configuration for the servers, you see that the server requirements are much, much simpler than they were for V1. We support upgrade, but it's really, when you look at the server configuration, we really can optimize the servers that you have there. Basically, if you're using standalone, we're recommending a two-box setup, and if you're using CM, we're recommending a three-box setup, and we'll go through the recommended settings on those. All right, so I mentioned that we now have these two modes of installation, two modes of deployment for MBAM. So the standalone, it's pretty much, for you guys who are familiar with MBAM V1, it's basically the same components. We still have the SQL Server, which is your repository for data. We still have the agent, and we still have the web services and portals that you can get the data from the database. The big difference for CM is that now, because we're saving that compliance information to CM, we're also depending on the CM agent. So if you are in CM mode, you actually still need the MBAM agent, but that agent will not report compliance. The CM agent will report compliance to your CM server. And you basically deploy a baseline, and you have a MAW file that you import on the server, and that's it. We just extend what CM was already doing. And then helps you in a few ways. I mean, your CM environment's already, you know, designed to scale, so the compliance data is usually the more heavy traffic between your client and server, so that's already offloading some of the traffic from the MBAM agent. But overall, I mean, the CM mode was really created to provide you guys with a more unified management experience. For you, you know, IT admins usually like to have one console where they can see everything, and the part that MBAM that you're really checking more constantly are the reports. So if you're using CM mode, you'll be able to just check those reports from the console that you're already using for other tasks. All right, server improvements. We talk about the performance and scalability. So two or three box setup recommended. Of course, you can still deploy it in as many boxes as you want, but you know, I can tell you from our experience, the Microsoft IT department deployed MBAM 2.0. We're running now over 200,000 clients, and they deployed in both ways because they really wanted to test the you know, both functionalities. But for both deployments, they're using the 2-box for standalone and the 3-box for CM. And, you know, you keep adding memory and you keep checking your disk usage, but that's pretty much it. If you want to split your roles, you're free to do it, but the initial cost of deploying NBAM is a lot lower than it was before. Mentioned TDE and SPN, which can be done outside of NBAM. A lot of people ask if TDE is still supported. TDE is really just the SQL technology we were just leveraging for NBAM 1.0. I believe we made an assumption that most people would like to have that turned on. We figure out from customer feedback that that's not always the case. So it's completely outside of NBAM now. Same thing with SPNs and certificates. Those are things that NBAM still depends on, but we're not necessarily forcing you to set those up while you're installing the product. And then on availability, we created a new VSS writer. It's, you know, we do have to comply because we're using SQL Server. We need to make sure that we're compliant with all the best practices technologies for SQL, and VSS Writer is the best practice for backups. There's always one question that comes at this point, which is about clustering and load balancing. That's still an area that we're investing. It's not fully supported out of the box, and I know many customers don't like that. What I can tell you guys is we're hearing that feedback, you know, loud and clear. We do have customers that go ahead and deploy on their own. The product doesn't have any hardware checks or any code limiting those deployments. It was really just a matter of cost on our side for testing and supporting those topologies. So for now, we're saying really, because it's such a simple deployment for databases and everything, you go with the standalone mode. But if you guys already have a cluster, you know, contact your Microsoft consultant or support, and we'll work with you there. All right, so this is more of a reference slide. It's a little crowded there, but it's just to let you know the versions we support. So we're still supporting Server 2008. You got to be on SP2 or R2 SP1. Server 2012, of course, the new edition. Client OSs, I mentioned that we added Windows 8 support. Enterprise only. So that's one of the differences when I talked about the scope of BitLocker and NBAM. So BitLocker does support Windows 8 Pro, but NBAM does support, does require Enterprise. And then Windows to Go, which is really not a different SKU, but it's a different deployment mode for Windows 8. Server, we support 2008 and 2012. And then on the System Center side, we support 2007 and 2012. Configuration Manager 2007 does not manage Windows to Go devices. That's a CM limitation, so if you're interested in doing that, we pretty much depend on CM on that side, so you need to use 2012. And the next slide is also a reference. It's basically the minimum requirements we have for our boxes for the 2-box config and the 3-server config. The 1-box, it's really just recommended if you guys are doing a lab testing or something like that. Again, nothing will prevent you from deploying it like that, but we really think for standalone you should use the 2-box setup at least. And then I don't have the requirements for the CM boxes here because those don't change. Those are the requirements that you have for any CM deployment. We just leverage whatever CM environment you have. Yes, so the question was, can we use VMs for the servers? The answer is yes. And I mentioned MSIT, the Microsoft IT, using 2 servers and 3 servers for 200,000 plus, and they're using virtual machines for the server roles. All right. So let's look at the standalone architecture. So if you know NBAM V1, you should be familiar with this, but I want really to show you, for those of you who are new to the product, how this looks like. So the animation is a little long here, but what we're really trying to show you is that you have your client, you have your portals running on the web server, you have the web services also there, and then you have your SQL side, the SQL database and the compliance reports. This is really, it couldn't be simpler, really, if you think about it. It's just the client, an agent, talking to a server, and you have group policy pushing down your configuration for BitLocker. The configuration is as simple as, you know, whatever you already had for BitLocker, We do add a few new policies there because we have to worry about intervals, how often that agent wakes up, how often you want to report compliance, that kind of thing. But at the end of the day, we're saving recovery data to a database. We're saving audit and compliance data to a database. We have some web services in the middle feeding our portals, and we have the help desk portal and the self-service portal. That's about it. And SSRS is just the engine for the reporting side. There you go. And it all feeds back into the database. So let's switch to my laptop, and let's do our first demo here. So let me explain to you guys the setup I have here. So I have four VMs running here. I have one for my standalone deployment, and I'm using just the one box. I have a DC that is just for the environment. We're not going to look at that. And then I have a configuration manager box here. So first, I want to show you the standalone. So I'm not going to run setup. Setup, really, the important thing for setup you need to remember is when you're running it, you should have all your prerequisites already taken care of. So look at the documentation. I know people don't like that, but the setup will enforce the prerequisites. So look at, you know, do I have .NET installed? Do I have my certificates ready? Do I have my SVN set up? Do I want to use TDE or not, even though TDE could be done afterwards? So just take care of that. Setup will be really simple. It will give you basically the option to install either standalone or CM mode, and then we'll give you the roles. So if you're running setup and you just want to install your web services and websites, you check those boxes and check everything else. If you're just installing your CM mode, again, just check that checkbox and go through there. Setup will take a little while because of account verification and all that kind of stuff, but I don't think it's usually where people have issues because of all the steps, all the accounts that you need to make sure have the right access and all like that, but it's really a simple process at the end of the day. So once you're done with that, this is the main deliverable that you have on your server. This is the help desk portal. So you can see here we have four options. I already have the report loaded because I didn't want to have you guys waiting on that loading. So basically, the enterprise report, you can see we have three types of report at the top here. You have the enterprise report, computer compliance, and recovery and audit. The enterprise report is where you start. It will give you the categories of computers who are, you know, either encrypted, non-compliant, and exempt. When I show you guys the client, I can talk about the exemption process, but it's basically just a hook to whatever process you already use in your corporation. So here you'll be able to see the numbers, and please, the data here is just test data. We have to inject the data. It's not really thousands of clients talking to my VMs here. That would be way too complicated to set up. So the data is not really business logic checked. It's just to fill out the database. So one example would be you can click on a whatever computer, you know, this computer, for instance, is not compliant, so I would like to understand why. It brings up the computer, and it brings up also each one of the volumes. Again, don't look at the protector types and all that kind of stuff. But if you look, the important part is that you can see here, it will give you the view of each one of the volumes there, and it will let you know, is that volume encrypted? Is that volume, according to my policy, compliant or not? You might have, in your environment, just the policy for OS drives. So your FDD, your fixed data drives, might be unencrypted, and your computer might still be compliant. Compliant really means, does it match the policy that I push down to that computer? All right, system overview is really just giving you an introduction to the portal. Managed TPM, this is where we manage the TPM key, the TPM hash. One change for Windows 8 is that if you're using auto-provisioning for Windows 8, Windows will own the TPM. If Windows owns the TPM, the MBAM feature for managing the TPM hash will not work. In order for that feature to work, you have to use MBAM. MBAM needs to own the TPM. So it's a choice. There's so pros and cons in that, you know, trade-off. If Windows owns the TPM, you gain some of the advantages that Chris talked about. If you still want to use NBAM to manage those keys, you turn off auto-provisioning and you use NBAM to take over the TPM. Some customers used auto-provisioning and then they reassign the TPM to NBAM, and there's a lot of details to talk about there. But overall, that's the message. The feature is pretty much the same way that it was for NBAM v1. The only difference is really on the way Windows behaves and not so much NBAM. And then Drive Recovery, which is really looking at this at the portal along with the reports, that's the main benefit. And one of the demos I want to show you is, and unfortunately I won't be able to use the remote desktop because it won't allow me to connect to this machine. So this machine here is playing the role of a client. And you're probably familiar with the screen here. This is where you type your password. So let's say I forgot my password. This is the recovery case where, you know, something happened. I either forgot it or I typed it wrong. So I want to recover. And let's say in this case, I want to have my help desk recovering the key. For whatever reason, I didn't deploy the SSB. So you click on ask, or if you type it several times, it would just show it to you. And then you have the recovery key here showing. That's the end user information that will be given to the help desk agent. So just to make sure I don't type this wrong, I copy and paste. That key will always be the same because it's really the identifier for the volume. As the help desk agent, and you set that up and your groups and users, so the way you manage access for this part of the portal is you assign users that have access or not to it. But as far as the website is tracking, you can recover keys for any user. So if I type the first 8 characters, you don't need to type that whole 32-bit key there. And you select whatever happened here. So let's say I lost my PIN. You could enter the user domain and user ID, but here is really optional because you're working as a help desk user. What it will do is it will go to the database and it will recover the recovery protector for that volume. So that key is part of that volume, is part of the protectors for that volume alongside the password. So even though I forgot my password, by getting this recovery key, I'll be able to unlock that volume and then, you know, do whatever I need to do. I could either reset my password, or if I had to, I could unencrypt my drive. So we should be able just to copy this. Go back here. Thank goodness I don't need to type that. And there you go. So it's very important for you to define who has access to that website, of course, because it is something that is very powerful. You can unlock any computer on your environment as long as you have that key there. So at the same time, that's very useful, is also very powerful. And that's one big thing to remember when I show you guys the self-service portal, which has a completely different security model. So we'll look at the client later when I show you guys the agent experience. But for the standalone mode, this is really what I want to show you. This is the help desk portal for the standalone. So let's go back and talk about the configuration manager mode. So this is a very similar diagram to the one I showed you for the standalone. The difference here is that we have a new box for configuration manager, and we have a new client component, which is the config manager agent. So all that does is feeds the compliance data to the CM database. Everything else is pretty much the same. You still have the same web services in the middle. The difference here is also the management console, which reads the compliance data, and it will show you the reports. So let's look at CM and see how different that looks. All right, so going back to my demo environment, this is my Configuration Manager 2012 console. So a couple of things I want to show you. First one So I am on assets and compliance. The first thing we do is we create a collection for you. Now, some people, you know, it really depends. If you're a configuration manager person, you probably understand this, but for people who are new to CM, this is an important point to make. This doesn't mean that you should only deploy the agent to the computers on that collection. That's really just a starting point. Within your company, it's very likely that you're going to want to segment those users, or maybe you do not want to deploy MVM to Windows 8 computers for whatever reason, or you don't want to support certain versions of TPM, so you could change the query. All we create here for you guys really is a query that will look at your environment, at the computers who already are listed in CM, and create that list for you. So it's really almost like a get started benefit for you. Now, for my environment, because this is a test environment, I have zero computers there, but in a real environment, you would see, by default, all the TPM-capable Windows 7 computers and all the Windows 8 computers. VMs are not supported on the client side. So somebody asked me about the VMs on the server side. That's totally supported, but it's not supported on the client side. So we would filter those out here as well. The second thing we create is, under monitoring, we create reports. And those are supposed to be equivalent to the ones that I just showed you guys. Now, one interesting thing, and that's just a little, you know, side effect of my environment here not being live, by default, we run the report against the MVM collection. Because the collection is empty, you don't see any value. So that kind of shows you how collections also work for reporting. You could have a department here, you could have Windows 7 computers, Windows 8 computers, you could do whatever you wanted. You just change the collection and do view report, and you will see the data for those computers. Oh, sorry, not all users, all systems. All right, and then what you see here is very similar to the one that we had for standalone. A bit of additional details here. So you can see that here not only we show what is not compliant and what is compliant, but we show you policy not enforced. And we also, unknown is really just a CM thing. It's basically meaning for whatever reason, CM was not able to deploy the package. So the computer probably has an agent, but the agent wasn't installed correctly. It could mean it's really the CM error kind of thing, and you go back to your CM deployment part of the agent and analyze that. But one cool thing that we have here is that the pie charts are clickable. So for instance, I could come here and I'll do that. I'll click on it and then we can look at the details just like we had for standalone. Looking at the non-compliant side, we also added a bit more detail. And those statuses are also part of the standalone database. It's just that we don't actually show that on the pie chart, and here we do. Now, because, again, this is just a test environment, we didn't have the information for this, but you can see we have several different categories there. So you can see where users postponed the encryption, where we were not able to find the compatible TPM. The TPM was visible, but it was not initialized. So we really go into a more level of detail of why the agent was not able to enforce compliance. And then finally, this is not part of the standalone. This is something new for CM. We have the compliance by volume type. What that means is your environment could have 1,000 computers, but it will likely have more than 1,000 volumes. So if you have, you know, OS drives will probably match to the number of devices, but then you have the FDD drives that are, you know, much more. And here you can see basically how you are comparing to those two types of devices, how compliant you are, and you know, you could see, well, something's happening to my policy that fixed data drive is really not becoming compliant as OS data drives are. So you could start your investigation there. All right, so I mentioned that this is clickable, so you could come here, click on this, and then again, don't look at the data, this is just example data, but then again, you have the view of your environment, and you can drill down and look at the systems, look at the different volumes for each one of the computers, and then you can figure out, well, you know, is the protector on, is the encryption on, and go from there and pretty much see what was wrong with your environment. All right, and then the final thing is you can also look at the baseline. So you have two things that you need to remember when you're using CM mode. You need to import the MOF file, and that's also outside of setup. You can do it before or after setup, but you do need to import the MOF file before you get agents reporting back to the server. Otherwise, it's not going to look right when you look at the reports. And then you have the baseline that you need to push to your agents. So those are two extra steps that you need to do when you're deploying to CM instead of standalone. All right, so let's go back to our deck and talk about migration. So if you are using MBAM V1 and you want to go to V2, we support the three major versions that we released for MBAM V1, which was the original RTM, the R1, which was the language update, and then the hotfix. Of course, we recommend that you're running the hotfix, but if for whatever reason you didn't get there, you could go from any of those three starting points and go to 2.0. It will really depend the whether the transition is easy or a bit more complicated. It depends on whether you're going from standalone or standalone to CM. If you're going from standalone, the only thing you need to do is you rerun the MBAM setup. It will give you the option to remove the components. Behind the scenes, it will still leave the databases behind. So your recovery keys, your compliance data, and your audit data will all still be there. When you're reinstalling the server and you're going through the setup of the database components, you've got to remember to set the database to that same instance so you keep the data. Nothing prevents you from setting up a new instance of the database. I mean, the main consequences will be you have to wait until your whole environment reports back to the server to get accurate compliance data, and you will not have those recovery keys. You have to wait until the agents, again, report the key back to the server. The agents will report the key every time it can talk to the server. So it will kind of self-heal if something happened to the database. But you got to imagine a situation like this. The day before migration, my computer talks to the server, sends all the information to the V1 environment. I go on vacation, put my computer in a closet somewhere. I'm out for a month, and you do the upgrade during that month. If you don't use the same database and you just get rid of that V1 information, I come back, I open the cabinet, and my computer's not there. So the question that security is going to ask me is, was your computer encrypted or not? The IT admin will not be able to tell because my computer has not connected to the server after the upgrade. So that's why when going from standalone to standalone, we really recommend you to keep that compliance data there so you can have that kind of reference for this type of scenario. Now, what do you do if you're going from standalone to CM mode? You got to remember, CM mode, we start to save that compliance data to CM. And during the upgrade, because we really don't have a special script or anything, you will have the compliance data for V1 still on that database, and the new compliance from V2 will be saved to CM. So what we recommend is do exactly the same thing that you do for standalone. Upgrade, keep the database intact, point that database to the V2 instance, CM mode, because that database will still be used for recovery keys. And even though the new V2 agents will not be saving the compliance data to that database, the old compliance data will still be there. So if that scenario I just mentioned happened, you will not be able to use the report, but you'll be able to ask your DBA or somebody who has access to the database to simply look up by user ID or by machine name and give you that information. So it's not a great story, but you're still covered. All right, and talking about upgrades, this is really a simplified version. Of course, we have documentation on this, and you guys should read it. But this is just an overview of the process. So you start with your server. You want to install your servers, install the new servers. Your current agents will still be able to talk to the new servers. Whatever policy you have there, you go ahead and install the new policy for V2. The important thing to keep in mind at that point, though, is even though your policy will be a V2 policy, the agent will be a V1 agent, so it will still behave as a V1 agent. And there are some changes on the policy behavior that I'm going to talk about when I show you the agent. So it's really recommended that you go through those three steps as fast as you can, but it's, you know, not practical to imagine that's going to happen all at once. So as long as you have the servers in place, then the policy, and then as a final step, as you upgrade the agents, it should all work, because it should behave as a V1 deployment right until that last step when you update the agent. As soon as the agent is updated, it will see that the policy contains the extra V2 information. It will start acting like a V2 agent, and then you get the full benefit of the upgrade. All right, some of the considerations about, you know, when you're going through an upgrade. The key recovery, even though I mentioned that the agent kind of self-heals and it will regenerate that data, it's important to understand that using the same database is really important, because you also have the chance that I go into recovery while the upgrade is happening. And you also have to imagine that the first thing you got to make sure you have up and running is your help desk portal, especially the key recovery part. So it's probably a good idea to get that tested very well before you start the upgrade, because if your, you know, VP calls in the middle of the night and says, well, you know, I'm at the airport and something happened and I need my recovery key, and they say, well, we're going through an upgrade and I really don't have access to that data right now, I don't think that would be a good thing. So that's the key recovery part. The compliance information we talked about. Another interesting thing there just to consider is that CM might take a little while to populate that that compliance data. You control the cycles for standalone as far as compliance being reported. For CM, it becomes part of the CM cycle. So whatever is your interval for reporting hardware and software inventory, MBAM will be part of that. So just be aware that whatever cycles you have there will be the cycles that MBAM will require to repopulate that database, which you will want to do anyway, because, you know, we don't provide a way to migrate that compliance data to CM. And then the final point there is that the new functionality might impact end users. A quick example of this is, let's say your policy for V1 was TPM. That's your protector required for your OS drives. In V1, if I am an admin user and I went to BitLocker and I added a PIN, I'll be reported as non-compliant, because it really compared what you had to the policy. V2, we're smarter. We say, well, if the policy is TPM and you added something that's more secure, like TPM plus PIN, we'll still report you as compliant. So there are several differences like that that might, number one, change your report information, but also trigger changes to the user. For instance, in V1, if your policy was auto-unlock and you had a password on your FDD, it would prompt you to remove that password. In V2, we don't do that anymore. So there's a transition there. It's usually easy, because what usually happens is people go from a less strict mode in V1 to a more strict mode in V2, because we give you more control. But if you're going the other way around, you might get users confused and say, well, you know, I never had a PIN before. How come you're asking for a PIN now? Well, because my policy now is different, because I can, you know, control that policy a little better. All right. The final part of our presentation is talking about end user experience. And that's, you know, it's really important to understand the changes we have here, because if anything, that's where you're going to get your support calls once you deploy MBAM V2. So first of all, the agent still plays the same role as it did before. First thing it does is escrow the key. So we check if your computer can talk to the domain. So if you're not logged into your domain and the agent is there and you have policy, we're not going to try to enforce policy, because we cannot do anything until we escrow that recovery key. The install for the agent follows the same model as the CM install. So unless you use a special command line option, the end users won't really know that MBAM is running. We don't have a system tray icon. We don't have anything. The only time that end users will see MBAM is when we prompt you to a policy, either encrypting drive or a policy change. We still have our MBAM control panel. The main reason for that control panel to exist is because for Windows 7, there's some functionality that only admin users could do, like reset your PIN. And we got people asking, well, as an IT admin, I want to give that option to non-admin users if I choose to. So that's still done through the control panel. BitLocker 8 added some of those functions to BitLocker now. So if you're deploying Windows 8, you might look at all the functionality we provide on a control panel and decide if you want to enable that or not. Something else we did there was for V1, again, we thought that was the right decision at the time, but we got feedback otherwise. In V1, we disabled the right-click on the drive and some of the out-of-the-box BitLocker behavior. Now that's all back on by default. If you want to turn that off, you can do that using registry keys on the BitLocker side, not on the MBAM side. And then enhancements to the agent, how it plays with BitLocker. We support pre-provisioning. So Chris was talking about the fact that use space encryption is really a time saver. You don't need to wait until your 20 gigabyte drive is encrypted. It will just encrypt during image, whatever part of the drive that's used. We support that. So you can do pre-provisioning with BitLocker. We can pre-provision MBAM, and there's a special registry key, all the different tweaks that you have to do there, which means once you deploy your image, if BitLocker was on and MBAM is there, you turn on the agent and we'll just escrow the key, report compliance, and everything will be set. And something else we added is that if you're in suspended mode, we pretty much do what Windows does for Windows 8, we do for Windows 7, which is we let you suspend BitLocker, but after you reboot, we'll re-enable it for you so people don't suspend it and just forget it in that state. All right, so I started to talk about the concept of minimum bar. Just to explain this a little better, so what we did for V2 is that you as the IT admin, when you define policy, you define the minimum level of security. So for OS drive, the clear example is TPM, right? You can choose TPM or TPM plus PIN. Choosing TPM plus PIN means that you're going to ask all your users to enter a PIN. A lot of companies, for instance, Microsoft, target some of the users to have a PIN, but not others. So if you have users that you consider to be more at risk, you have TPM plus PIN. If you have other users that not so much, you just do TPM. Now, if those users that get the TPM policy still want to add the PIN themselves, they can do it, and they will still be reported as compliant. Same thing on the FDD side. If you want to only require auto-unlock and allow users themselves to add password, your policy should be auto-unlock. If you set auto-unlock and password, you're actually forcing during the wizard process that the end user will enter the password. And then finally, there the support to Windows to go. This is, again, it's a BitLocker function, so it's a new protector. It's a password protector for your OS drive. So it looks pretty similar to the password protector that you have for your FDD drive, but it basically replaces the TPM protector for the OS drive. One limitation that's important there is we allow you to apply that for machines that do not have a TPM. So if MBAM recognizes a TPM on your machine, we'll not give you the option to use password on the OS drive, only on the FDD. You could run into situations where the TPM is not working and will think that machine doesn't have a TPM. We will allow you to add a password, but once the TPM is enabled, we're going to look at the TPM policy and say, hey, you really need to add this protector. We'll leave the password behind, and you can remove that individually. All right, final demo. Let's go through this one so we can have some time for questions and answers. So what I wanted to show you here is now that we have our client running, let me log into it. And I want to show you the second part of this, which is, oops. All right, so the way I prepared this machine here is that I have three drives. As you can see, the OS drive is encrypted and unlocked because I just typed my password. And here is MBAM. It's faster than I thought. So the E drive is encrypted and it's locked. So what you can imagine here is I have a password protector for this fixed data drive, and I haven't typed that password yet. Now my F drive, I unencrypted, was initially encrypted, but I unencrypted. So as you can see, BitLocker MBAM popped up right away. Now this is a test machine, so I put the cycle every minute, so it's checking all the time. Depending on your environment, you should have that to 60 minutes, 10 minutes, whatever you think it's reasonable. But the important part here is that's the scenario where I was trying to cheat. You know, maybe initially my computer was image when it was provisioned. I said, for whatever reason, I don't want to have my F drive encrypted. You know, MBAM will prompt that, and it will actually force you to encrypt. Unless you postpone or require an exemption, which in this case is disabled, the exemption is a policy that you set, and it allows you through group policy to exempt certain machines. So let's say I'm a developer and I have a very valid reason for not wanting my drives encrypted. I would click on the exemption. When you configure the policy, you would have a website or an email address. You take over at that point. So at Microsoft, just as an example, we have a website. They go to that website. They send an email to a system admin somewhere saying, hey, I'm part of the development team for Windows, and I cannot have my drives encrypted. So that admin will move that user to a different group, and he'll get a different group policy, and that group policy will say, okay, MBAM agent, stop bugging that guy. So that will go away. For regular users, though, they will keep getting this until they comply with policy. All right, let's go back to the client machine, and I want to show you the second scenario for recovery, which is, let me postpone this guy here. So let's pretend again that I forgot the password for this guy. When I click here, it's similar to the experience I had before. I have a place to enter the recovery key, and if I go here, it will basically ask me for the same type of key that I typed before. Let's say in this case, though, I don't want to call help desk. I want to grab that key myself. So my environment is set up to have a self-service portal right here. All I need is the first 8 characters of that volume, just like we had for the other volume. So once this loads, the self-service portal, this is really the startup screen. We have this for compliance reasons. This is all out of the box. You have to change it. You have to add your own. Hey, if you're going through this process, there might be legal consequences if you try to do this for a computer you don't own, that kind of thing. And you update the top title to your enterprise name. Once you accept that, what's going to do is it's going to ask for that recovery key just like it did before, but the security model here is different, right? I cannot request a key for something I don't own. So what this portal does is it will only let you retrieve the recovery keys for volumes that are associated with your user ID. So if I was getting that first recovery key from your computer and I was typing it here, it would show me you don't have access to that key. It will let me get this key for this case because that's my user. I'm running this same computer, so it knows it's me. So I'm able to copy that key, go back to this screen, enter recovery key, and unlock it. And again, if you forgot your password, if you did anything like that, that's where you now have access to reset that password or an encrypted drive. Okay, last thing, Group policy, we really don't have to go through this. It's the MDOP-MBAM node here. You will see that we have pretty much the same organization that BitLocker does. The extra thing that you'll find is the client management. This is where you configure things like the rates that you want your client to report back to your server, the URLs for your servers, and everything else on the FDD, OS, and removable drives will be very similar to what you have in BitLocker. And that's, let's go back to our PowerPoint. That's our session for today. Hopefully we addressed all the session takeaways. We show how Windows 8 BitLocker is a lot easier to provision and the main features for MBAM 2.0. Thank you very much.
There's a survey that we'd love for you to fill out on the session. I believe that's being handed out on the way out.
So Terry probably handed you the survey.
Okay. Yeah, so we'd appreciate that feedback. We have some time for questions, so come up to the mic and let us know.
Hey there, I have a question.
Sure.
I'm over here on the side. Okay, well, first of all, you say the client install follows the SCCM silent model. Is there any way you can get a confirmation on successful install? Because they fire it off, and then it just starts up, and then it just goes away. So that's one piece of feedback I'd like to give you. The other one is SPNs are now optional.
Yes.
So why should we use them? Is there a reason to? And then the other one is, how are you able to encrypt that drive, that virtual drive, without using TPM?
All right. So starting from the end, that drive was encrypted because I had Devin Tess helping me set up that environment, because I wasn't... That was a virtual machine, and we don't support encrypting virtual machines. The protector itself is a password protector. So MBAM actually thinks that a VM is a non-TPM Windows 8 device. So if I actually tried to encrypt it, I would have to do some magic behind the scenes to work. It was just showing the flow for the agent. Talking about SPNs, this is really just a matter of your environment. SPNs are like... I'm really not an expert, but as far as I understand, they're aliases for your services. So we create services just like any other application that you would install, and we require SPNs just like any other application that you would install. So if your environment, for whatever reason, doesn't require that, MBAM doesn't have any special needs there. And what was the first question? Sorry.
Can we please get a confirmation of successful MBAM client install?
So if you look at the event logs, I'm pretty sure we do log that. And if you use CM, I mean, we're going to be an MSI package similar to others, so we'll report the default MSI return codes for you. It might be that we don't have the level of detail that you would like there, but we definitely have that. I mentioned our MSIT deployment. They tracked whatever client pushes were successful or not, and we actually found some issues that we had to address. So I know for sure that's working. Maybe it's just the level of detail or the event log that's not enough for you.
Yeah, I just wanted a little box to pop up so that the user knows, because sometimes you might have a user having to reinstall a client or something like that, or some help desk guy is standing there doing it, or he's doing it remotely, and so it just comes up and it just goes away, and then la-di-da-di-da, he has to go searching for confirmation. It's just easier if he just has a little box pop up and says, boom, installed.
Yeah, we kind of had to make a trade-off there. We don't pop up those messages because we assume that's going to be through CM or some other system that will monitor that. So in that case, where a help desk person is installing it, you would have to go to the event viewer and look for it. No problem.
Got a question there in the middle.
So initially with the recovery keys, with the FIPS compliance for 142, we couldn't actually store those keys in AD. They wouldn't let us use that. So am I hearing now that we can offload that to an encrypted secured SQL database and then bring that back, or do we still not quite meet that?
So it's two parts. Yes, for the first part, you can offload those keys to SQL, and you don't need to save those keys to AD anymore. There are separate policies. You have to go and turn off the policy for AD. However, FIPS has other requirements that we currently don't meet. They actually have a hardcore requirement on the way that we generate that numerical key that we currently don't meet.
Okay. Thanks.
No problem. Another question.
I'll let him go.
Go ahead. I have a bunch.
Okay. Only simple question.
All right.
Is there any way to force the pin change from MBAM? So you have a client like Windows to go want to change the pin on that device.
So we follow the domain password rule. So I don't remember if you can go to that policy and have like an expiration date. We don't add anything on top of that. So I'll have to go back and look at the way that the domain password is set. But I think they only have a complexity settings there. I don't think they have any kind of timeout kind of sessions on those passwords. So I think the answer is no.
Yeah, the answer is definitely no for that one. So the feature he's looking for is the ability to every 90 days have the user.
No, actually, first time. So let's say you image a Windows to Go device, you give it to somebody, yep. And you put the pin in.
Yeah.
So you want the user first time to change the pin. You know, like first time or force a password to change on.
Have them set the pin after it's provisioned. So set. Oh, for Windows to Go,
it will actually. If you do pre-provisioning for that, what's going to happen is MBAM is going to pop up, and it will ask you for a password. So until you enter that password, you're not going to have your drive actually encrypted. So you're going to have a clear protector, but you won't have the password protector.
No, we're trying to encrypt the Windows to Go, give it to the user. So I'm encrypting the device. I'm an IT, and give it to the user.
Yes.
I need to put the pin. So me and IT, I could put generic pin, and everybody would know those generic pin. So
that's right.
Defeating the purpose, right?
So currently, I understand the scenario, and the best solution would be for you to add a pin, but then also have a flag that says reset on first login. We don't support that. What you can do, however, is you can pre-encrypt that device and have MBAM pop up for the password. If the user doesn't add the password the first time he logs in, it won't be protected. That's the trade-off there.
Okay, thank you.
No problem. Your turn.
Yeah, we did a migration to from 1 to 2, and I have to thank you for that installer. It was just simple. It
awesome.
Just worked. The question I have is, on the GPO, what needs to be touched if all the settings are the same? We didn't take advantage of any new GPO settings. Is there something I need to make sure I edit just to make sure that the group policy looks like a 2.0 group policy?
If you're not using CM and you're pointing to the exact same servers, it will probably work. I would recommend
It is working, but I'm afraid something in the background is hidden.
It will probably work. I would still recommend you to go and install the 2.0 templates.
Yeah, I've done that.
Copy and paste whatever settings you had before, just to make sure.
Actually make a new group policy and just copy the settings?
That would be the best way to do
it. Also, can they change the installer so that it'll work on Windows 8 so we can use it to install the policy settings? Currently, it won't run on Windows 8 Enterprise. At least the installer we have just pops up and says, this OS isn't supported, won't even let me install the templates. So we had to manually copy the templates, which is no big deal, but it's an extra step.
Yeah, it checks for Server 2012, so I don't think we can override that.
And the one feature, which is the policy templates, we usually do from a workstation.
Yeah, that's a good feedback. If you could contact support, you can submit like a DCR request. Just mention that because I don't see any harm in allowing that. It's just probably something that we didn't test it. So
I will let somebody else. I got a bunch.
All right, thanks. I think you're next.
Are there any known issues with if you install 2.0 with CM on 2007 and then you migrate to CM 2012? Are there any known issues with that?
The only issue that I can remember is that you have to, and the documentation will have that, I think it's a release note. I think you have to update the version of the baseline so it deploys the baseline again. Otherwise, it will keep the old baseline and I think it will have trouble talking to the new server. As far as I remember, that was the only thing. We didn't go through the upgrade for the Microsoft environment, but we tested it in our internal environment, and it just worked. All right.
Okay. Looks like we got time for one more question. We're down to 15 seconds.
All right, and then I can follow up with you guys offline. So you want to go
real
ahead?
Real quick. We're using Active Directory to store the keys, and we're using Configuration Manager 2012. Is it necessary to use MBAM? I mean, what extra functionality do you get with MBAM if you're...
Well, for one thing, the reporting. If you don't have MBAM, even though you have CM, you will not be able to report on compliance.
If you import the MOFS into Configuration Manager, you still won't get it?
Well, no, because you have to actually deploy the baseline. And the baseline, what it will do is it will talk to a component that's a MBAM component. So it's really, without you deploying the MBAM agent, the CM mode won't really do anything for you. No problem.
Yeah, so we got to wrap it up here, but let's take some more questions. We can move forward, but we're going to have to release the room to the next group. So thank you very much for coming.
Thank
you. We appreciate all the questions, and we'll take some more up front here.